From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Churches were built all over Georgia during the late 18th and early 19th centuries. They were social and spiritual centers from across mountains, the Piedmont, to the swamps and pine barrens of South Georgia. They're of all dimensions and denominations, and some have lasted down the years in fine shape. Some require restoration. Those buildings prompted Sonny Seals and George Hart to publish Historic Rural Churches of Georgia. The book inspired the Saving Grace series on GPB.
So then it came a time that we wanted to have our own church so we can worship in freedom. So you got the first African Baptist church. We built it ourselves, our ancestors. Storm would come, maybe tear the building down or whatever, but we'll build again because we wanted God. Save up our money. And religion is a major part of our culture.
Sonny Seals is producer of the series and joins me in the studio to talk about Georgia's history through rural churches. And Sonny, thanks so much for being here.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Documenting these historic churches began with your own family story. What happened? What was the beginning?
Yeah, people always want to know, how in the world did this get started? I got into history late in life. George and I are lifelong friends, and every now and then we just take some time off and we just head out and hit the back roads and stumble around farmhouses and old towns that had disappeared, and cemeteries covered with weeds and that sort of thing. We thought it was exciting for some reason. So on one of these trips, went through this town that is just about gone. It was called Powelton. And there was this, there were two churches in Powelton. Actually, one of them turned out to be the oldest Baptist church in the state of Georgia. The center of that church was built in 1798. On the other end of what had been a town was a Methodist church, and it had some old graves in there. And I walked up to one of them like I always do, and there was this Confederate gravestone, and the name was William D. Seals. And so I thought, well, I have to be kin to this guy, I think, because there are not many, many people with the surname Seals. It's fairly unusual. So in today's age of technology, all I had to do was go get on the computer, and I didn't know where I came from. I could only go back to my grandfather. And very quickly, I found out, wow, I came from England in the mid-1600s. We came into Virginia, and we came down through North Carolina and South Carolina, and we fought in the Revolutionary War, and they were giving away land in Georgia after they took it away from the Indians. And so we said, yeah, we'll take some of that. And we did in 1785, settled into what is now Hancock County, you know. And I found out that story is not unusual at all. It's very typical.
And that started this odyssey. It's interesting that this is that was a digital sort of plant that opened up this world to you. And what you've done is very analog, going to rural churches in Georgia, across Georgia, seeing them, some of them faded in time, some of them empty of congregations, others not. But what did these tell us? The churches have largely lost their position as communal gathering spaces. What was its role historically?
Well, if you look at how Georgia got started, you need to look at some old maps. But after the Revolutionary War, remember this, the only land that existed that Georgia owned was down on the coast and a little bit along the Savannah River. The rest of it belonged to some other people called Creeks and Cherokees. Georgia was known as the debatable land. And so very quickly, we started acquiring, buying, stealing, choose your own verb there, all this land from the Indians, river basin by river basin. So by 1830, all the Indians were out of Georgia. And to that extent, Georgia happened almost instantaneously. So you had 40 million acres of virgin forest. Well, what do you do with that? How do you settle it? Well, the way they did, these settlers moved in on this free land, and they very first thing they did was set up a church. And the church was absolutely the center of everything. So didn't make any difference what the denomination was. The church served the function of community center, country club, dating service, law and order, and yes, some spiritual comfort.
Well, most of the churches you feature, they weren't built to withstand time in the same way as the old shrines and stone basilicas that pilgrims went to for many years. How many of them are lost or even beyond repair?
A lot of them.
Yeah.
Well, what you have to remember is, you know, you make do with what you have. And all they had in terms of building materials were trees and rocks. So that's where these churches were built. As an interesting side note, I think about this all the time. Thank goodness for the emergence of tin as an affordable roofing alternative. Hmm. Because if it were not for tin roofs, none of these churches would that we target would survive.
When did they start making churches with or tin roofs?
I'd say about 1880s.
Mm-hmm.
Before then, there was some form of shake roof or wood roof. But even if you use composition, you're going to get in trouble. The combination of tin and Georgia heart pine is very powerful. It'll last forever if you keep the water out of it.
Sometimes it's the congregation that is gone. It's not necessarily the church is degraded. They were built when rural communities still had industries and thriving populations. So looking at these churches, what did they tell us about those changes in the way our economy and society evolved?
Well, the churches reflect reality. And the reality is that as Georgia shifted from an agrarian society to an industrial society, there were pretty much massive migrations to where you had to go to get a better life. And if you think of Georgia in terms of agriculture, you have to think of it in terms of pre-Civil War, post-Civil War, and one word sums it all up, cotton. Mm. Cotton was at the root of a lot of dark history.
King cotton.
Yes, King cotton. And Georgia was almost a one-trick pony when it came to cotton. Well, the combination of the Civil War, declining population, lowered prices, and the boll weevil just kind of did us in. So a lot of people left. It's that simple. When they did, there's nobody to go to church.
My guest is Sonny Seals. He's author with George Hart of Historic Rural Churches of Georgia. It's a beautiful picture book and also the series on GPB called Saving Grace. Well, Sonny, how many of the churches that you've chronicled have continually occupied with congregations and how many no longer hold services?
I'd say of the, we have over 200 churches now that we've researched and documented on the website. And I'd say roughly a third of them are doing well. They really are. They have vibrant congregations and they don't need any help.
What qualifies for your study? Which years or what state?
It's a good question. We say what qualifies for to be included on our website, the church has to be, the congregation has to be formed prior to 1900. The present structure has to be at least 100 years old. It has to be in a rural location, and we define rural as either in the country or in a town of less than 2,000. If we didn't stay rural, we'd lose our focus in a hurry. But the hard part of qualifying these is they have to have some historical architectural interest.
Mm-hmm.
There has to be something of the past left. A lot of these churches have just been overly modernized, and they don't work for us.
Yeah, these are some simple, beautiful rooms. In many cases, light and airy. There's a new episode of Saving Grace that features former President Jimmy Carter, his famous Sunday
yes.
school service at Marantha Baptist Church in Sumter County. People from all over the world, all over the country. But he also talked with you about his family church.
I would say for a long time, almost 100 years, after the Civil War was over, the African-American and white congregations worshiped on their own. Maranatha wanted to integrate our church racially, and so Maranatha was formed for that reason and also to permit women equal rights with men. So that has been our church ever since we joined it after the White House years.
That doesn't fit the common narrative of the South, an integrated church and also women part of it?
Well, if you think, you know, in terms of old churches, You have to think pre-Civil War and post-Civil War. Pre-Civil War, as President Carter points out, blacks and whites worshiped the same God. They sang the same hymns. They studied the same Bibles. They had the same services, and they might have been segregated in seating. Most of them were. After the Civil War, some sweeping changes happened in America, but certainly in the South, and Georgia was right in the middle of so much of that. And so through these old church minutes, we see a different view of history, a different interpretation of it. For instance, President Carter talks about his great-grandfather's church when he first came to Sumter County in 1852. The minutes of that church revealed that in 1870, this is fascinating to me, in 1870, 5 years after the Civil War, 40% of the members of that church in good standing were African-American still. Now, that's the same year they also, very peacefully but in an organized manner, decided they wanted to form their own church. And they did. In 1870, they left and with the assistance of some white people because they needed all the assistance they could get. The Civil War was just desperate times for everybody.
So this church and these minutes, these are all pieces of history. But we also have in a lot of towns in rural Georgia, other relics of history. You have the abandoned factories and farms and stores that didn't survive and are now faded. Why, Sonny, should churches be preserved?
Well, churches are a special, I'm searching for the right word, a very special historical aspect of our history. And churches have the ability to give you a historical perspective that you can't get anyplace else, but churches have the ability to move people. They're important on a spiritual level that moves people for different reasons. Sometimes it's religious. Sometimes it's history. Sometimes it's genealogy. Sometimes it's the sheer beauty of the architecture and the simplicity of it. It moves different people for different reasons. But it's a very special part of our history. And to put it in simple terms, I ask the question, look at this book, look at these churches, look at these structures, look at these stories, and you tell me, are these historical treasures or are they relics of the past?
Sonny Seale, he's producer of Saving Grace. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Enjoyed being here.
Saving Grace airs on GPB Monday nights at 9 and Saturday mornings at 10:30. And you can see photos of some of the churches and episodes that have aired at our website, gpbnews.org. Now, Saving Grace also tells the story of one of Georgia's greatest cultural treasures, the Gullah Geechee community along the coast. And the music you're hearing now is a 1926 recording of Kumbaya, as sung by Gullah Geechee man named H. Wiley. It's the first known recording of the song. The New York Times unearthed this recording from the Library of Congress. Up next, Mary Frances Early couldn't attend the symphony when growing up in the segregated South, but she broke ground as the first African American to get a master's degree from UGA. She joins us with her remarkable story when On Second Thought continues. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. This week, NPR 1A will be broadcasting from GP, and tomorrow on the show, we're going to hear from the host, Joshua Johnson. He's hosting a panel at GPB on Thursday night, and the public is welcome, but you do have to sign up. Details are at gpbnews.org, but please join us for that program tomorrow. As we prepare for election in 2 weeks, accusations of voter suppression and political power grabs are in the national news. Paper Gods, a novel of money, race, and politics, uncovers a conspiracy that reaches into the heart of Atlanta's political machine. As a political strategist and commentator, Goldie Taylor has a warts-and-all view behind the marble corridors of government and is here to talk about her new novel. It's in stores today. Goldie, welcome.
Good morning, and thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, congratulations on the novel coming out.
Long road, but here we are.
There you go. Let's talk about that long road. But first, sure. The thrill of the book. The novel begins with a very dramatic opening in the prologue. You know, one of the characters gets rushed to the hospital after a car wreck, and boom, we are off. Is that how it began in your imagination?
It is. You know, my rule, I think, for writing novels or screenplays or whatever I put down on the opinion column, is always set the bomb off and, you know, first. And that really flings the conflict forward. But this book, according to the latest reviews, it starts with two booms. And so there's a lot of booming in this book. I did enjoy it.
Well, and a terrific character. One of the main characters is Mayor Victoria Dobbs. She's a masterful politician. Equal parts grace and guile, says one of the characters. Who is she?
You know, Paper Gods, to be honest, is what we call a Romany Clef on Atlanta politics. And so there are so many people and places and situations that people will just simply recognize. I think there are a number of people who are wondering if they're in this book. But Victoria Dobbs Overstreet, the protagonist in the book, she really is a compilation of mayors. I took Shirley Franklin, Kasim Reed, Bill Campbell, wrote this before Mayor Bottoms took office, but took those three mayors and I fused them and created a whole new being in Victoria Dobbs Overstreet that she has all of the charisma, you know, of a Bill Campbell. But she's got the kind of guile that you would find in, you know, old ward politics. She knows her way around this city.
You've worked on several political campaigns. So if you were Victoria Dobbs Overstreet brand manager, what would you be saying about her? How would you be selling her to the people?
I think Victoria is a creature of her upbringing, of her environment. You know, she's truly Atlanta made. She is the kind of mayor that gets it done for constituents, but she knows how to play ball in the smoky back room. She's not the kind who, you know, will demur and shrug off. And most of all, she makes no threats. So if she says it's coming, it's coming.
She's Harvard-trained attorney, a Spelman alum, married to a heart surgeon, mother of beautiful twin girls. Everything on the outside certainly looks pretty great. How is it on the inside?
All that glitters is not gold, certainly. And so we not only explore her time as a mayor and how she deals with conflict and how she deals with tragedy, but we also see her in her home and how you navigate a marriage when you've got two incredibly powerful people, you know, fused together in a partnership, you know, one who was wealthy all of his life and the other who came up from the dust and clay. And how do you negotiate those things? We explore domestic violence, for heaven's sake. We explore Citizens United and dark money coming through campaigns. And so I used Victoria sort of as a tour guide to walk you through our region of politics around here. But I set them up in a way that really does make them larger than life.
Yeah, and there are so many sites that would be familiar to somebody from Atlanta, especially African-American Atlanta, the centers of Sweet Auburn Avenue, the Ebenezer Baptist Church, historically the economic center, certainly, and cultural center of Atlanta. But there's also this character, Ezra Hawkins. He is an esteemed African-American former civil rights worker who is now a member of Congress.
He is a congressman from the 15th district.
Any idea where that one came from?
No idea whatsoever where that might have come from. But he is modeled on, again, a number of, you know, historic figures. You know, John Lewis certainly being one of them, being, you know, congressman from the 5th district. But I literally, in this book, split Atlanta in half. And so John Lewis is the congressman from the 5th to the west. And my character, Angela Hawkins, is the congressman from the 15th district to the east. And so, you know, you have to sort of create this brand new world. My real feeling about, you know, how you build a world and place these characters in place you have to let them do the talking. And so I had to almost forget everybody I really know and know well. But if you worked with me on a campaign, their chances are you're somewhere in this book.
I was thinking then, does everyone think when they're talking to Goldie, wonder where that's going to pop, if I'm going to pop up in her next book?
I've gotten a number of calls. You know, in the early 90s, you know, I was working on Michael Lomax's campaign for mayor when he ran against Bill Campbell. We got slaughtered in that race, by the way. But their book came out called A Man in Full. It was a War and Peace in Lenten written by the fabulous writer, the late Tom Wolfe. And, you know, I read it, and everybody in the city read it. There was so much chatter going around about it. Sam Massell, the former mayor of Atlanta, hated the book. And I read it, and I said, what if someone told the story of Atlanta from the inside? A Man in Full felt like a tourist document to me, taking me, you know, pointing me out some things. But in my book, I take you inside the private bar at Chops in Buckhead. You know, I take you, you know, into the Magnolia Room. I take you to Manuel's Tavern. I take you places that other books really can't go. And I give you the kind of personalities that you're going to find there. And so you're going to see, again, people, places, street corners that you recognize. And because I know the city so incredibly well and I love it so much, you know, I'm going to live here the rest of my life, that, you know, the kind of beauty and reverence for the city, I think, comes through.
Is their dialogue as sharp and crisp in real life?
There is. As you notice, there are some sharp elbows in this story. My antagonist, well, one of them, Virgil Loudermilk, for heaven's sake, is he's long on metaphors and colloquialisms, but he is a kingmaker if ever there was one, billionaire, owner of a huge media conglomerate, Delacorte Enterprises, in this book. And when he and Victoria go toe-to-toe, when they strip off the gloves and the fight really begins, then you sort of begin to understand the North Side, South Side divide in Atlanta. You begin to understand, you know, how gentrification has, you know, really impacted our city, diffusing African-American votes in the city and bringing really the chance for a mayor who might not be African-American in the next couple of cycles. And so we explore really all of that in about 300 pages. But we talk about, you know, how campaigns are funded and then where the votes come from.
Well, and the pacing is a lot more interesting than reading a policy excerpt.
I sure hope so. Sure.
I'm speaking with the Atlanta author Goldie Taylor. Her new book, Paper Gods, is out today. Goldie, I want to go back to what you said about, you know, creating these composite characters and wondering how you work that through in your mind. I know some authors I've spoken to, they think about what would they have for breakfast in the morning and what would they call their wife or husband or whatever. How deeply do you have to get into that character to make them speak, as you say?
Well, everything I know about the character, and by the way, I always say that Victoria Dobbs moved into my house, Virgil Loudermilk moved into my house, the reporter on the scene, and there always is, you know, a Wiley reporter on the scene, Hampton Bridges, he moved into my house. And so I knew everything about these people. I knew what they liked for breakfast. I knew how many miles they ran. I knew where they went to church and, you know, what kind of relationship. But all of that doesn't particularly show up on the page, but it is certainly illustrated in what drives them. And I reveal from time to time, you know, what might have been behind one character story or another.
But you also have to make them very plausible. And that, I guess, is grounded in your work as a political strategist.
I think what was so very important to me is that there had to be a realism about Paper Gods. You know, the title itself, Paper Gods, sort of stands for people who get their power by paper. You know, not the Heavenly Father we're talking about, but the people who walk this earth, people who get their godliness from business, from the faith community, from civic and political power, from being, you know, part of that estate, you know, in terms of media. So I put together really all of these gods who are gods on paper, and I let them go to war.
And there's another metaphor working here. It also refers the title to a little piece of origami. So this folded, interwoven clue of sorts left behind. I wonder, when you're making the plot, is it a little bit like that? You fold this here, that there, trigger what? I'm imagining either a really organized whiteboard or a bunch of post-its stuck on a bulletin board? What does it work for you? How does it work for you?
It was a little bit of both. And so you start out with this outline of how you think the story is going to go, but suddenly the characters start speaking for themselves, and so that devolves into post-it notes at the end of the day. And so I really did let this fly apart on the page. But that paper god, that piece of origami that travels throughout the book, really does tie everybody together. It is, you know, it is a piece of, it's almost mystical. When it shows up, trouble is coming. And there are very few people who understand its meaning, fear it, know to fear it. And there are people who have used it in the book to bring great harm to others, to signal great harms of others. And so the paper god does indeed represent, you know, sort of this ominous tragedy that's coming. But it also represents a device called braiding, and how I flip from chapter to chapter, braiding the characters together, the subplots, the main plot, into a tightly, you know, sort of woven piece of macrame.
You are a strategist, aren't you? This is how you do it.
This is how you do it. This is how you do it.
Well, the book does highlight business, politics, the paper gods of religion, you know, or those holding power in churches. Do you think this is how it is handled, particularly in Atlanta?
I do. You know, there is, for all of the fictional elements of Paper Gods, and absolutely it's a work of fiction, the realness in how it reflects how we do business here, how politics get done, how the deals get made, how we influence what's happening in Washington, what our linkages are. You know, how we play ball under the Gold Dome. There is a level of realness there. And by the way, the one piece of the main piece of plot, I can't give it away, but it happened. There was something in the book called Reclaim Atlanta. And those of you who know me well know that in, you know, the middle 90s, there was something called Reform Atlanta.
Mm.
And so Reclaim Atlanta really is based on a real case that came before a real judge in the city, and that, you know, real mayoral candidates fought over Reform Atlanta. Well, there is another fight over Reclaim Atlanta, but this one is deadly.
You're telling secrets then.
I'm telling secrets.
So does that get you any, does that block any access for you in the future?
Ah, I'm not going to run any more campaigns. So yes, I am retired from politics. Absolutely. I am, you know, writing screenplays and novels, and I'm editor at large for the Daily Beast, a position that I absolutely love. But I am retired from political campaigning. You know, I have coffee every morning with sort of this group of fellas at my local Starbucks. There's about 10 or 12 old men that I sit down and have coffee with every single morning, 5 days a week. They're convinced that they're going to be in the next book. And, you know, maybe. But sure, I have... I've gotten calls, emails, text messages, you know, from well-known folks around here who want to know if they're in the book.
Uh-huh. Well, the character of Mayor Dobbs, this is a study in corruption on many levels.
Yes.
In many different characters. But that's what's kind of fascinating. It's not, I'm going to be nobody sets out to be a corrupt politician necessarily.
No one does.
It's the death by a thousand cuts. It's those little junctures, those little decisions you make that get you deeper and deeper. How did you witness that in your role as a political strategist?
You know, I think that at the heart of this book and at the heart of, you know, my work in politics, that I came to realize very early. I did most of this campaign work in my mid to late 20s, early 30s. I'm now 50. And there is the frailty of humankind. You kind of get to know that. But for a very small set of special and rare people, transformative politicians, transformative business leaders, and we have a bevy of them in and around this city, that almost everyone else is corruptible in some way. And so when we, you know, watch what happens out of a city hall or out of a state house or out of our airport, or, you know, how developers do business in the city and how that stuff sort of comes together, that's where the realness is in this book. You know, how we do business here has as much to do with the relationships that are built over decades and the history of families and how those families came together and created, you know, global national businesses. And then, you know, how those relationships inform how we do business today. Who gets elected to the mayor's office, how and why?
And this book, now coming out a couple weeks before the election, is this time for a good political thriller?
You know, I think that as where political thrillers go, that this book and there are some others sort of out on the shelves, it's people really want a diversion, I think. They want an escape from, you know, what's happening in Washington, the kind of ideological divide that some people say we haven't seen before in our lifetime. I think we actually have seen this kind of vitriol before, especially in the 60s era, you know, civil rights movement, that there really were these very strong poles and that there was really no middle ground. You were either for it or against it. We're in that time again, but I think there are people that are just tired, that they'd like to, you know, life to get back to normal. But in the meantime, if they want to escape, if they want to have a little fun with this thing,
well, you got
Paper Gods is the book for you.
There's the pitch. Goldie Taylor, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Goldie's new book, Paper Gods, is on store shelves today. And stay with us for Mary Frances Early, remarkable story of a real groundbreaker, when On Second Thought continues. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. The first class of women graduated from UGA 100 years ago. Their presence and resiliency changed higher education, but they were inevitably segregated. The first African-American woman admitted to UGA was Charlene Hunter Gault in 1961. She inspired Mary Frances Early to attend a year later. Early was the first Black UGA graduate with a master's in music education, and she joins me now to discuss her legacy at the university. Mary, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Well, so glad to have you here. You attended high school in Atlanta in the 1950s. You were in the school band and nurtured your love of music. What was it like there in high school?
Well, it was the same high school that Charlene and Hamilton attended, although I was 5 years ahead of them. And I need to say that actually I went to University of Georgia the same year that Charlene and Hamilton went, in 61.
Okay.
Not a year later.
Well, I'm glad you corrected me. Thank you very much.
It's okay.
Like a good teacher, and you became a music educator many years later. But when you were growing up, you grew up in segregated Atlanta. What was your exposure to music then? Because it was symphonic music you loved.
It was symphonic, and we couldn't go to the symphony because everything was segregated. But what my dad did was he had us to sit around on Sunday evenings together as a family and listen to the Bell Telephone Hour. And they played light classical music, they played opera and Broadway music. And I learned to love music and wanted to. Actually, I started piano as a result of that.
Mm. And before you applied to UGA for graduate school, you were working as a music teacher in Michigan.
No, I was going to school there.
I am just getting my facts all wrong.
That's okay. That's all right. I was teaching here in Atlanta at John Hope Elementary School, which is on Boulevard, in the Fourth Ward, very close to Dr. King's Church. But I went during the summer. You know, teachers have to go during the summer to summer school.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the University of Michigan 2 summers before I entered the University of Georgia.
Why did you decide to go to University of Georgia?
I saw a riot on television, a little black and white television, showing Charlene and Hamilton being escorted back to Atlanta, suspended for their own safety. And I said, they can't do that. I wanted to do something to help with the civil rights that was going on, the marches. And I knew I couldn't do the picketing and sit-ins because I was an employee of the state and I would have been fired. But I thought, I can go to school. So I decided, I told my mom that night, I'm going to transfer to the University of Georgia from Michigan.
Well, so that was a really quick decision. And before you applied, you had to go through getting, it was a pretty lengthy process, let's say that way.
Yes.
The difficulty was more and more barrier supposed to discourage you and other African-American students from applying. What kind of obstacles did you have to overcome just to get that application in?
Well, when they got my transcripts, they found that I was Black. And they asked for my high school transcript, which is very unusual because I had gone to college and finished. I was in the master's program at the University of Michigan. And what they didn't know was that actually my high school transcript was even better than my college. Mm. And then I had to go to the courthouse to get a signature from the judge saying that I was an upstanding citizen. I don't know how he was supposed to know. And actually the clerk of court signed that. And then there was an investigative report that was done that actually I didn't know about until the year 2000. But they investigated my background, if I'd had a venereal disease, if I had shoplifted, been arrested, if I'd had an illegitimate child.
Mm.
But they tried to find some way of disqualifying me, but I wasn't a paragon of virtue, but I certainly wasn't doing any of those things. Well, and then there was an interview on campus, and at that interview with the registrar, which was required supposedly, I was asked if I'd ever been in a house of prostitution. And that just really destroyed me inwardly. But I knew that he was trying to goad me into disrespecting or saying disrespectful things, and I wouldn't rise to that challenge. I kept my cool, but I was really very angry.
So what taught you, what prepared you for that, keeping your cool, being grace under pressure from what the sounds of it?
My parents, they were my role models. And although we grew up in a segregated society, they did not teach me to disrespect people because of their race or to blame them. They just told us that, you know, you have to have character, you have to get education. That is the road to progress. And you can do anything that anyone else can do if you're prepared. And I think it was watching them, observing them, learning from them that I was able to do it.
Well, despite jumping through all of those hoops, you were admitted. When you finally got to campus, do you remember that first day, what it was like?
Yes, I do. I had a white student, an art student, who was a graduate. She was in the graduate program, who met me at a local dentist's office, and we went to registration together. When we walked up to the registration line, it was very noisy when we approached. But everyone turned around and looked at us, and it was just quiet. I didn't know what to expect. And I think had I not been with a white student, it might have gone much worse. But that was a very scary moment.
Right, because you had seen images on television of riots, Charlene and Hamilton being, you know, taunted, pretty much chased out. So you were prepared for the worst.
I was. In fact, I was assigned to that same room that Charlene had been in, right on the street, vulnerable to bombs, to rocks, to whatever.
What happened to her?
Well, she was, at the time when I went in the summer of 61, she had gone to the Louisville Times, I believe, as an intern. And Hamilton had gone home, and I think he was working as a lifeguard. So I was a lone Black on campus, except for people in menial positions.
So Hamilton Holmes, I don't know if we've said his last name yet, Charlene Hunter Galton, Hamilton Holmes. Two other African Americans were admitted to UGA before you.
Yes.
You, however, were a master's student. You were had been to Spelman, Clark, sorry. Oh. But this is a huge challenge. And I know that other people that we've spoken to, women who integrated grammar schools or lower schools, have talked about the incredible loneliness of that experience. What did it feel like for you?
It was very lonely. At the University of Michigan, you know, I could walk and talk with classmates, white, Black, it didn't matter. And it was a very liberal campus. But when I went to Georgia, one of the things that the students had said in a proclamation was that they would not welcome us, and that any white student who welcomed us or was with us, would also be ostracized. That first summer where I was alone, it was very lonely, and I was not accustomed to that because I'm a gregarious type person.
Do you think you would have had the same perspective had you not been to Michigan? You talked about the experience in Michigan, not a segregated school, certainly not absence of racism, I'm guessing. But you had a different perspective from the outside. Was that different than the people that you left behind?
It was quite different. I mean, I knew I'd grown up in Atlanta, you know, with the white and colored water fountains and going to the Fox, you had to go up the back steps. I knew all of that, but I just didn't expect it at the University of Georgia. I had, I guess, a dream that things would be much the same, but of course they were not. And I had thought that graduate students, because Sharon Hamp integrated the undergraduate school and I integrated the graduate school, I thought they would be more mature because they were mostly teachers like me. But that was such was not the case.
How did they treat you?
They would sit as far away as they could. They would not acknowledge my presence. And that's very hurtful because everybody wants to be at least recognized. If I spoke to them, I would be rebuffed. They wouldn't say anything. I remember going to the Ag Auditorium to take the graduate record exam, and I sat down near the end of the row. And when I sat down, all of those on that row got up and left. That was not a very good beginning to a very difficult exam. But I had to push it to the back of my mind, and I did, and I was able to pass.
But there you are, head down, taking your exam, not paying attention. Was that your experience at UGA? Did you just get your work done?
I did. There was nothing else to do. Athens was not integrated, though the University of Georgia was, and it was a small town. There was nowhere to go. I went to the Killian's restaurant, which was a black-owned restaurant on Broad Street, occasionally when I got tired of being ignored or listening to taunts, because there were things that were said and things that happened.
The silence of taking that exam and then putting your head up when you're finished and looking at everybody else gone— It's a different kind of response rather than jeering or shouting or throwing things. Silence,
right?
Doing things, withdrawing quietly, that has a whole different, I would imagine, psychological effect.
It does, and it really gets to one's psyche because you wonder, you know, am I unworthy? Why am I being treated this way? I am not dirty. You know, I don't smell. What's the problem? But, you know, I think it was the musical South Pacific where that song was sung, you have to be taught very early. Mm. And I think that this was a result of those students having been taught by their parents because we all lived in the South. But it was totally unnecessary because I was not going to bother them. But it was that you were excluded. And I was.
Did you stay friends with that white art student that you mentioned?
No, because she was getting ready for graduation and had a show. But I did. We stayed in touch for a couple of weeks, but that was about it.
What did you do musically while you were there?
Well, I was not a performing major. I was a music education major. Mm-hmm. But I remember once going to a practice room not to practice the piano for a lesson, but to go through a score that I was studying in music history. And someone blocked me in. From the outside, a practice room.
They locked you in the room?
Huh. Yes. And there were not the security guards that they have around now. When I finally, and I get claustrophobia when I'm in a small enclosed space. When I finally got someone's attention, this guard came to the door and unblocked it. And he said, you shouldn't be here at night. And I said, but I'm a music major. I have to work at the piano. But he didn't say anything about those who pulled a prank.
Yeah. What did that experience do for your experience of teaching, this transformative educational experience?
Well, I taught at a segregated school. I never taught at a school that was integrated. But my students, I felt, needed to know. I didn't talk to them about those experiences, but I tried to instill within them the need for taking care of business in terms of going to school and staying on target with your teachers, listening to your parents. I tried to help them so that if they were ever faced with that, they would be able to manage it, as I did.
You eventually became the director of music for Atlanta Public Schools. Have I got that right?
That's correct.
So the schools only integrated around the time you were at UGA or afterwards. So what was it like to be the only person in authority in a major school district like that when in your own high school days you couldn't even attend a class with white students?
That's true. And, you know, I had white teachers and black teachers alike and principals, black and white. But I had no problems in working with any of them because I think if you do a good job and people know that you are really sincere in your love for music and education, they really respect that. So I had no problems with that.
How about your graduation day? This was 1962?
Yes, August 16th.
What do you remember about that day and receiving your diploma? Was your family there?
Oh, yes. I had invited my parents to come to a chorus concert because I was in the summer chorus, and I was told that the campus was only integrated for Charlene Hamilton and me. So they said that they could not protect my family on the way to or from the University of Georgia. And so I didn't want them to come. But for my graduation, I didn't ask permission. And I think there were about 74 people who came, family, church members, classmates from college. And as I stood in line, there were only five of us getting the Master of Music Education degree. No one would speak to me.
Mm.
And that was very unusual. No administrators, nobody. And I knew that this was a watershed moment because they were about to give a degree to a black person. That was not my incentive for going, but it just happened that way because I had graduate credits from the University of Michigan, which they did accept. And I had gone back the spring of 62 and gone through the summer of 62, and that's how I was able to complete. But it was a surreal feeling because I was not being accepted, and yet I was getting a degree.
Yeah. There are now campus buildings dedicated to Charlene Hunter Gault and Hamilton Holmes, but you have largely been left out of early accounts of UGA's history. Why is that?
You know, I don't know. From my first degree in 62, because I went back and got a second degree as education specialist, but when I was in 62, from that time for 38 years, I was completely erased from UGA's history. I have no idea to this day why. But in the year 2000, after I was, quote, discovered by Dr. Maurice Daniels, who was actually a professor in the School of Social Work, and he was doing a documentary on Horace Ward. And he was told by Attorney Hollowell and Jesse Hill, Jr., that I was actually the first to get a degree, and he didn't know anything about it. He had never heard my name. So he did some research, and then he called me. And I was invited to come back to campus. And I spoke in the year 2000, and I've been recognized ever since.
And telling your story ever since. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Atlanta native Mary Frances Early, the first black graduate student from UGA. And you can learn a lot more about her life through the GPB documentary, Mary Frances Early, The Quiet Trailblazer. That's it for our show for today. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back again tomorrow with more of On Second Thought. You can stay with us on Facebook, on Twitter, and on our website, gpbnews.org.